Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employee Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. Wow, that was lightning speed on the underwriting announcements. Way to go. Okay, there's a lot going on in the world and here in the local community. So I guess we'll start out with some news stories. Who'd like to go first?
Well, I've got one.
Who's speaking here today?
All right, this is Jim Iman, former railroad worker, Local 1382, United Transportation Workers Union. On Counterpunch, there is an article by James Kilgore, one of the leading lights in CU Citizens for Peace and Justice, on black prison organizing that I think everybody should take a look at.
Okay.
And last year, it turns out there were over 1,000 labor strikes in the People's Republic of China. Over 1,000, which means 2 or 3 strikes every day.
Wow.
It occurs in China.
Were there a lot of strikes in Vietnam this week or last week?
Yes, I believe so. That? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of ironic how these countries that are supposed to be People's Republics, Socialist Republics, have now become in sweatshop,
Well, Dave, I'm thinking we put that war in the win column.
Okay.
Now, I mean, look at what's going on there now. This terrible capitalism, basically. State mm-hmm. capitalism, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Impression.
Indeed. Gus, what do you have for us today?
Yeah, just to talk about, we've been doing this past couple of weeks a bit of updates about the economic situation in the country. There's been a lot of talk about what's going on in terms of possible layoffs and another recession coming. So there's a couple of updates about what's going on with the working class people. Some of the poorest people in the United States will no longer be eligible for food stamps in the next 18 months, and some states plan to kick them off the rolls even faster. And this is according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. So what the study is saying, that roughly 1 million of the nation's poorest people will be cut off SNAP, which is the food stamp program, over the course of 2016 due to the return in many areas of a 3-month limit on food stamp benefits. For unemployed adults aged 18 to 50 who aren't disabled or raising minor children. So these individuals will lose their food assistance benefits after 3 months, regardless of how hard they are looking for work. Bill Clinton's 1996 welfare reform legislation, what I like to call welfare deform,
yep,
at the time, required able-bodied adults without dependent children to work at least 20 hours a week to qualify for food assistance and other benefits. So following the Great Recession, however, at least 35 states took advantage of federal waivers allowing them to extend eligibility for food assistance to unemployed people beyond the 3-month limit, because those states face persistently high joblessness.
Mm-hmm.
So, but with unemployment rates falling, some 23 states will cease to qualify for statewide waivers in fiscal year 2016, according to the Agricultural Department. Even more troubling, a number of governors looking to score political points at the expense of the poor won't even seek a federal waiver, even if their state qualifies for it. And we already know what's going to happen with air around there.
Yes.
Yes. We already know. Yeah. So this is becoming a serious crisis in the sense that we're looking at, we talked about this off the air, that they've already rolled back food stamps a couple of years ago, and now they're about to roll them back again.
Yes.
Next year.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
and it wasn't that generous to begin with.
Yeah. I mean,
think we knew a guy, a friend of ours, Bill, Tom, I think no more names, but no last name, that is. I mean, what he was getting a month, I mean, he had to go to food pantries to basically get through.
Yeah, man,
you know?
I love friends that are on SNAP,
mm-hmm.
and I worry about them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're disabled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's a pretty bad thing. And there's something else too, like these new laws they're trying to pass, or they're passing in state. I can't remember which states are in right now, but about how if you're getting any assistance, you can't go to a swimming pool
what?
Or to the movies and this and that. What I was wondering is how do you enforce that?
Yeah,
you know, how did the people at the swimming pool or the movie theater know if you're on public assistance
yeah.
or not if you have cash.
Indeed.
And they're also limiting these people to $25 cash a day. Like,
mm-hmm.
you can't, like, withdraw your whole check at once.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
In a lot of cases. But I can't remember what states, like Kansas or something like that.
You know, I'm on some of Carol Ammon's constituent committees, legislative committees, and I know we on the Health and Human Services Committee, you wouldn't believe the crap, the bills that they've sponsored, you know, trying to get passed, including there's one that I couldn't believe that actually got bipartisan support, both some Republicans and at least one Democrat, to want to do a, now this is interesting because obviously they're trying to get their foot in the door with this one and making it sound like, oh, it's no big deal really, is that they want to do a 2-year pilot test program in 4 counties in Illinois, of drug testing public aid recipients.
Oh yeah, I remember when that first, they started that back in Florida.
Yes.
Yeah, and which is the most ridiculous thing ever because it proved the exact opposite of what they were trying to say, in that most people who need that type of assistance don't use it for drugs, and yet they're still piloting this in other states.
Yeah.
And what that did was, they had to pay for how many thousands of drug tests that people passed. And you know, I'm seeing less drug testing in the construction industry.
Really?
But yeah, because I think, they're finding it to be ineffective and it hasn't really changed much of anything.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just another means of control, you know, the employer having more control over you, in the workplace. I mean, you know, it's one thing having sobriety tests, to see if you're fit to be, you know, come to work and do the job that day, but it's another to see what you did 2 weeks, you know, off the job site, you know, 2 weeks prior. That's ridiculous. And I think this is just, all this stuff is, they're just trying to make it more difficult for the poor with the case of the drug testing for the food stamps. I mean, it's just another way of trying to make poor people's lives more difficult.
Well, and also too, at least one person I know who's disabled and, requires, you know, medication, they drug test her
mm-hmm.
to make sure that she's taking that medication.
Really?
Yeah. And also, you know, to look, I suppose, to see if she's medicating outside of their program.
Mm-hmm.
You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Okay. All right.
Well, on this point, now we know that the current governor, I hate to even use his name, Rauner.
That's Reichsführer.
Rauner. has gotten somewhere. has partially.
Okay, Bill, we're not on television.
Yeah, not great love. Right?
Yeah, right. Bill's pervading Dr. Strangelove here and trying to hold his arm down because he wants to make a
Nazi
Sieg
Heil salute, yeah.
sign. Now Pamela's lost a key ingredient in her dialysis, and they're looking for another one to supplement it.
Because this was what was cut off just by Rauner's executive action?
We think so. Mm-hmm. We can't prove that.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. if he can, he's going to try to get rid of Medicaid altogether.
Yeah, and make Illinois union free, according to one of the internal Rauner documents that's been floating around. So, I mean, I think that's almost a violation of the law and his oath as governor. I mean, to try to deny people their legal rights to, you know, a free association and right to unionize.
And even taking this further down the road, you're talking about food pantries that are already stretched to the max.
That's right.
So by doing this by 2016, the increase for demand is going to literally empty food pantries. So you're talking about hunger issues going on in America, and there's this big ridiculous stereotype that there are no hungry people in America, mm-hmm. and they're made by Republicans and other rich people who mm-hmm. have never actually been into an urban center or been to these areas to see these people starving. It's going to get worse at this point because these pantries are going to run out of food.
Yeah, and it's going to affect poor rural areas too, and there's a lot of those in Illinois actually. And you know, what's interesting is that, what do you think this is going to do to the crime rate? I mean, people start getting desperate. You know?
Well, and you're talking about the rural areas. I do notice around the small towns around here, and it's largely because of the cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in BMET, there was kind of a major little, somebody really had to get activated years ago to get sidewalks fixed because there were so many people that with walkers and wheelchairs and such that they were having a hard time getting to the grocery store.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I work road jobs in a lot of these small towns, and I see the people driving around, and they're elderly, and they're infirm quite often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here we go, deteriorating infrastructure on top of all this other stuff. What else do you have for us, Gus?
Let's see. Well, like I said, you know, just to continue this situation going on with the police brutality stories, the Madison students right now are really up in fervor. A couple of weeks ago, I updated the World Labor Hour on the story where a Latino student was shot and killed. So let's just to give you some testimonies from some of these students who have organized their communities right now to confront the police. And what they're doing is they're not just saying, "We are against police brutality." They're actually holding police accountable for taking a human life away from the community. So they're actually going into the stations and they're going into these areas and organizing and telling police, "We're not going to have this anymore and we're going to hold you accountable anytime you do this." So one of the testimonies says, "I'm a senior at East High. I got arrested for fighting for what I believe in. I was fighting for my cousin, Tony Robinson, who was shot by a Madison police officer on March 6th. And we're out here protesting today. And I stayed out in the street when they asked us to leave. So I got a truancy ticket and an obstructing traffic ticket. Hopefully we can get answers to the questions we need. And if not, we're going to keep doing what we're doing now until we get it." And mm-hmm. that's the kind of drive that we need to spread across the country. And we're not just talking about police brutality. We're talking about union work. We're talking about education. We're talking about all these other things that are affecting working class people, that we have to stay consistent and keep doing it. When somebody gives us a ticket or somebody does something to us, we have to show back up again and do it again. That's how change happens.
Indeed.
So I really applaud these Madison students for this work.
Oh, that's excellent. That's an excellent story.
The same thing went on in Quebec City and in Montreal, where previously it was more or less a free education. Suddenly, their tuitions got jacked up.
Yeah, by the Harper administration.
There's another one.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like worse than Bush or somebody, as Harper is.
Yeah. Oh, he is.
I'm really disappointed in Canadians over that.
I'm telling you, Canada's really changed for the worse in the last 30 years. Horribly.
Right.
I mean, I really, long for the days of Pierre Trudeau, who challenged U.S. foreign policy and gave refuge to, people that were avoiding the draft in this country during the Vietnam War. I mean, what happened to Canadians' independence? It's just, it's acting like a 51st state of the United States now. You know?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, I did download something from RadioForAll.net, which was about a 30-minute presentation by an American deserter from mm-hmm. Iraq, because he had seen so many atrocities, he just couldn't do it anymore. And he's having a very difficult time in Canada.
Everybody that's went to Canada basically they've left the military from the Afghan and Iraq war conflicts have all either been returned to the U.S. or have been having a real hard time getting amnesty. Unlike the days when it was basically you could get across the Canadian border and we were, you know, basically free and you even got Canadian support, you know, government assistance.
Yeah. Harper is also trying to privatize medicine.
Yes.
Surprise. But I mean,
he's
right.
He's doing it in a sneaky, backhanded way, kind of like what's going on here with privatization of Medicare through these stupid, health oh shoot, I can't think of the name of them, but they're basically, instead of having state unionized workers administer, the state Medicaid program, they're having these privatized companies use workers that are low paid, no benefits, and very, you know, not very well trained.
Yeah. Okay. Hey Dave,
Medicare Advantage programs, that's what I was thinking of.
We could move a little farther south. I got about I think this is like a 3 or 4 minute news story.
Okay.
From Florida. And, basically what's happened in Florida, and this is ABC Action News.
Okay.
WTFS or something somewhere in Tampa, Florida. That's where it is. And, Walmart has closed or is closing 5 stores recently in different parts of the country, one in Florida. Well, there was one of these stores is the store that was the first store where there was ever a strike.
Really?
Yeah, and this news story is looking at that. They've been covering this. It's not a store in Tampa, but anyway, I'll go ahead and play this. You want to cue it up?
Yep.
All righty, here it goes. See if we can do this.
Closed this week, had a chance to learn more about their futures today. I-Team investigator Adam Walzer joins us now with what he's learned. Adam?
Well, Jameson, still a lot of mysteries tonight surrounding those closures, but we are getting new information that there may be more to the story than plumbing problems. A steady procession of Walmart employees filed into the Sheraton throughout the day.
I'm just going to basically meet with people and sit down and just interview to see what they have out there.
12-year Walmart veteran Luis Gonzalez was among 400 employees who lost his job Monday night when this Brandon store shut down with just a few hours' notice, leaving employees worried.
I just got dentures that cost me $7,000. Yeah, I need a job.
About 2,000 Walmart employees let go from 5 locations across the country simultaneously.
I think that was dirty, okay, because I know the store manager knew. Okay, of course he knew. They had too many things in place.
Walmart attributed all of the closures to plumbing problems.
I have to put some value in the fact that they're telling me.
This is a city council member.
Commissioner Victor Chris says a Walmart executive called him shortly before the closure.
He didn't mention plumbing.
The I-Team has uncovered no recent plumbing permits have been pulled at any of the closed stores. But one location has had issues of a different sort. The Pico Rivera Walmart was the site of the first ever Walmart worker strike in 2012. Riot police were called and 24 people were arrested there in November.
Are unions trying to get in there?
I have no idea.
Well, they haven't approached us. I've never been approached by a union personally.
United Food and Commercial Workers International, which has advocated for higher wages for Walmart workers, can't confirm whether any members work at the other locations. But recent injunctions have been filed by Walmart against the union in Florida, Texas, and California. As for Luis Gonzalez, he left today's interview relieved.
I will be going to another job, same pay as everything. I'm very happy with it.
All the Walmart employees who lost their jobs can attend a job fair next week where they will be invited to apply for positions at other stores. We asked a Walmart spokesperson at the hotel for an on-camera interview, but he declined our request.
Oh, goody, a job fair. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, okay.
It's a fair.
It's a good time. Gus, didn't you have an update on the 15 now?
Yeah. Just to bring up, kind of connect that too. We just had this major day on April 15th for the fast food workers and also just workers across the country for the fight for 15. And I just wanted, you know, the champagne, we had at least a couple, 3 or 4 dozen people come out to the McDonald's on Neil and Kirby and show the McDonald's Corporation, those ridiculous capitalists, how we really feel about them. And just to give people kind of an update of what's going on with that, just to give you some raw data. What's happening is that the richest 1% of American households make $327,000 in annual income. And what happens with it, if you're in that 1%, you get to pocket 17% of the country's 10 biggest tax breaks. So that's a gift of $153 billion each year to the people who need it the least. Now, to put it in perspective, it would only cost $20 billion to bring the pay of all workers in major fast food chains up to $15 an hour throughout the entire country. So $20 billion taken from that $153 billion, which is only a gift. It's not part of their actual profit or their income, but it's a gift. Get that $20 billion from that, and that's a scratch. That's nothing but a scratch. But again, to the ruling class, though, That's still $20 billion of their gift money that they refuse to give out to these workers who cannot feed their families or having trouble with benefits and things like that. $20 billion out of 153. And that's the kind of thing we were fighting for. And to be honest with you, it needs to be higher than 15. Mm-hmm. But just getting the 15 is something that we really, truly believe in, and that you can't get to a livable wage. So April 15th was a major date, and we're going to hopefully plan something for the future, too.
Yeah, and that happened all over the country, too. So,
all over the country, yes. Nationwide.
Okay, I got one new story here. I'm pleased.
And internationally.
Yeah, internationally, too.
Internationally.
At the monthly meeting of the Champaign County AFL-CIO of Champaign County, the delegates unanimously endorsed House Resolution, U.S. House Resolution 676, the Medicare for All single-payer health care bill, and they're going to be basically working with the National Campaign for Single-Payer. This makes the Champaign County AFL-CIO the 151st Central Labor Council in the country to do this, and it's the first in Illinois. So, anyway, okay, we're going to take a quick music break here, and we will be right back. And we got a guest calling in from Oakland, California. So stay tuned. We listen to World Labor Hour on Listeners Party Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Well, I didn't bring my headphones.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. The empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. Still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
Okay, I was James McMurtry. We can't make it here anymore. And I got some quick public service announcements before our caller scheduled to call in. April's Speaking of Democracy on WFT from 1 to 2 p.m. will feature the work of two men, well-known men of the 20th century, Social Science of the Public. Doug Olive will summarize the book, The Lonely Crowd, by sociologist David Reisman, which focuses on the changing 20th century American culture and individual character. Following that, Doug will read an insightful anti-war statement by a renowned psychiatrist, actress Carl Menninger from his book Love Against Hate. So tune in to Speaking of Democracy with Doug Olive today from 1 to 2 p.m.
Oh, by the way, Dave, yes. We're on Pledge Drive,
your pledge
would help support what sounds like a really interesting show. So please call 359-9338. No pledge is too big nor too small.
Thank you, Bill. Okay, today at the Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway, the downtown Urbana Post Office building, the 2012 Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein will be speaking at the state conference, which is going on right now. Jill Stein was born in Chicago, Illinois, and was an MD, retired MD in internal medicine, and she was a principal organizer for Global Climate Convergence for People, and besides serving as the most recent presidential candidate in 2012, she tried to enter the debates with her running vice president at a debate in 2012, and her running mate were arrested, taken into police headquarters, and handcuffed to a chair for 8 hours.
Yeah, I believe her running mate was Sherry Honkola.
That's correct.
Of the
Poor People's Campaign, I believe.
Oh, that's what it is now?
Yeah.
Used to be Kensington Welfare Rights Union.
Okay.
And by the way, I voted for them.
Oh, I did too. Okay, and she's helped the lead initiatives promoting health in communities, local green economy, stronger democracy, including campaign finance reform, green jobs, and radically just redistricting on the front. And she was also on the front lines of Ferguson, Missouri, demanding justice for Michael Brown, as well as, anyway, she's all over the place, so you can come tonight at the IMC, Downtown Urbana Post Office Building. She'll be arriving in town right around 5 p.m. and tune out, you know, come out for that if you want. It'll be real interesting. Also, next Saturday, April 25th at 1 p.m. at the Champaign Public Library, Rauner is bad for workers, bad for Illinois. Governor Bruce Rauner began his term with an immediate attack on Illinois working families, including right-to-work laws that would dismantle collective bargaining rights. Join us for a forum on why Rauner is wrong for Illinois and what you can do about it. And this event is sponsored by the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, the Mother Jones chapter. That's next Saturday, 1 p.m. at the Champaign Public Library. And coming up on May 2nd to 3rd in Chicago is the Future of Left and Independent Politics, and it's basically about third parties and progressive Democrats cooperating on getting candidates elected, and it's really interesting. This is going to be going on for the 3 days, and some of the endorsers of this are really interesting. The people are Gail McLaughlin, who's the Green Party mayor of Richland, California, Bruce Dixon, managing editor of Black Agenda Report, Shama Sawant, Seattle City Council member, Howie Hawkins, Green Party candidate for governor of New York, Dan Labatz, co-founder of Teamsters for Democratic Union, Edward Eduardo Montinas from the Richmond City Council, Progressive Alliance. This keeps going on. Angela
Wow.
Walker, a candidate for Milwaukee Sheriff. she's from the Cooperation, and also this she's part of the Cooperation Jackson, the Malcolm X grassroots movement. It goes on. Let's see here. Wow, this is just a Cindy Sheehan will be there. Rosa Clemente.
Oh, by the way, Dave.
Yes, Jill
we do
Stein
have
again.
Cindy Sheehan scheduled for an interview.
That's right,
April 25th.
That's next Saturday.
Is that when this is?
No, it's a week after that. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And also Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. And man, this is just a unbelievable list here of Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report. So this is going to be a really interesting conference in
folks,
Chicago in 2 weeks.
And you're not going to hear about this on any other radio stations in this listening area.
Indeed.
So
yes,
please call 359-9338 and make a generous pledge.
Okay.
Have we any information on the 100th anniversary of Joe Hill's execution?
Thank you so much, Jim. I was just getting ready to say that. Yes, there's basically from what I've been hearing, I haven't I was supposed to receive an email on this. I made a phone call, but I haven't gotten it. Basically, there's going to be a tour celebrating Joe Hill's 100th anniversary murder of by the Utah the state of Utah, and there's going to be a tour around the country, and the Midwest segment of it's going to be May 1st in Chicago, and it's going to be a kind of a musical tour of various labor's songs done by various musicians and commemorations and stuff. So we'll get you information as it comes available here and everything. So anyway, we're going to take a quick music break. We're waiting for our caller to call in from Oakland, California. You're listening to the World Labor Hour, and yes.
And next week, Cindy Sheehan.
Indeed, Cindy
Sheehan. Class warrior as well as peace mom.
Indeed. Okay, we'll be right back.
One, two, three. Boycott. Boycott. Could be the strongest tool we got. Boycott. Boycott. Could be the strongest tool we got. Boycott. Boycott. Could be the strongest tool we got. Nobody gonna spend their money here. Hit the street, I'm telling everyone we meet. Hit the street, I'm telling everyone we meet. Hit the street, I'm telling everyone we meet. Solidarity's strong round here. Rank and file, rank and file, we're gonna go that extra mile. Rank and file, we're gonna go that extra mile. Rank and file, we're gonna go that extra mile. We got a good strong voice right here. Wildcat, wildcat, that's how we show 'em where it's at. Wildcat, wildcat, that's how we show 'em where it's at. Wildcat, wildcat, that's how we show 'em where it's at. There'll be no business as usual here. Organize, organize, that's how we cut 'em down to size. Organize, organize, that's how we cut 'em down to size. Organize, organize, that's how we cut 'em down to size. They ain't gonna steal our labor here.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is John.
Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm doing all right.
So this is John Ryman calling in from Oakland, California, retired union carpenter who was expelled from the Carpenters Union back in 2000 for leading a huge wildcat strike in the San Francisco Bay Area. And John's been on the show many times, including once in person in the fall of 2008, right when the financial crisis and bank bailouts were happening. So, John, what have you been up to lately?
Oh, not too much. Doing a little bit of traveling and you know, watching and being involved as much as I can in the whole movement around the issue of police brutality and police murdering people and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just read, I don't know if this is accurate, but I just read a statistic that last month the police killed over 100 people in the United States.
Wow. 100 people? That just to that one month?
That's what I read. I don't know if this is accurate, but what I do know is, according to an article in the Wall Street Journal, that the official FBI count of the number of people that the police killed underestimates it by about 45%, because many of the killings by police are not reported to the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
They figure about 45%. And so the latest year for which they have figures, which was 2013, the actual count is about 645.
645 just in that 1 year period?
People killed in 2013 by the police.
2013 by the police, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, and It seems to be getting worse. It kind of reminds me of what's happening with the state of Israel, where the more they're criticized, the more they take the position, well, we don't care what anybody outside of ourselves says. We're going to just keep on doing whatever we want to do.
Yes, indeed. It seems that way.
Yeah, it's definitely getting worse, and you can see that. You know, the more action and the more demonstrations and the more protests that go on, the more police shootings become more rampant, you know, because again, in neoliberalism, when you have democratic ideals, the neoliberal theory is that repression must match that democracy. So the more we amp up democracy, the more repression has to squash it, because it's going to interfere with the process of neoliberalization. So yeah, you're seeing a ramp up of this stuff, and you're seeing more publicizing of it because of we're standing up against it now. So, like I said, we're at a war. This is really a war-like situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's happened in the United States is ever since capitalism went on its downtrend and the attacks on workers increased, that they had to, that was when they stepped up all the propaganda about violent criminals and so on. And, of course, central to that propaganda is hidden and sometimes not so hidden racism.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and part of that was, you know, glorifying the police. They are the thin blue line that stands between us and complete chaos. And increasingly just giving them a free hand. So, really, it's kind of a symptom of the crisis of capitalism as a whole.
Yeah, you know, it seems like they've got. It seems to me that they've got bigger plans. In other words, I think they want to push the United States standard of living for working people, as well as in other countries, down to what the situation Greece was in. You know, that wasn't just about banks, you know, being paid back their money. I think, and I'm not the only one that thinks this, that Greece was actually a laboratory just for the ruling class, the international capitalist ruling class, just to see how far they can push working people down and until they fight back.
Dave, don't you think that if automation was fully employed to the hilt, that there would be tens, if not hundreds of millions of superfluous people in the modern, or the Europe and the United States?
Probably,
and,
yeah.
And the more mm-hmm. industrialized parts of Asia.
And your point?
My point is superfluous people. People not needed. By the rulers.
Okay.
They don't need the workforce anymore.
Yeah, but their problem is if they just basically kill them off, then they kill off their markets also.
Indeed. Yeah, who's going to buy their crap, you know? That's the thing. I mean, you know, but anyway, John, you know, you were in Ferguson when everything went down, you know, the shooting of Michael Brown and everything.
Right.
And you said there was a recent shooting out in Oakland, the police shooting, a police killing.
Trying to think of what.
Well, maybe I misunderstood you on that, but I think you were talking, wasn't just talking in general about, you know, what's been going on, you know, around the country and around the world with police repression and everything, and, you know, how this all ties in with a lot of different things going on out there. They're not disconnected, they're all interconnected, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, like I said, you know, they have to give the police increased power, but not just absolute power, but kind of hold them up and glorify them, and in a sense, to a great extent, have them stand above the law.
Yeah. And like I said, you were in Ferguson when everything was, you know, pretty heated up down there and everything.
In August.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And what were some? You know, I know you've talked about this before, but maybe you could tell the listeners a little bit about some of the things that really impacted you from that experience when you were in Ferguson.
Well, first of all, I should just say if you look on my website, oakandsocialist.com, I have up there a Skype interview with an activist, a grassroots activist in Ferguson that I just did about a week ago.
Oh, okay.
People might find that interesting. But, I mean, the big thing to me when I was there, I felt like I was back in the 1960s, like,
wow.
It seemed like the entire black community had mobilized around this issue.
And it was a lot of younger people, basically.
That's
just
what I'm saying, yes. Exactly. And not just like your typical political activist. Not by any means.
Okay. Yeah, and you were talking about the role of some nonprofits and some, you know, certain religious leaders that were coming in, and you were saying about how you thought that instead of trying to help the people, that they were actually working on behalf of the powers that be.
Well, that interview that I did with her name is B-Girl for Life, that I did with B-Girl, she talks about that quite a bit. And, like, one thing that I saw when I was there you see that street of West Florissant, what is the was the kind of that's kind of like the center. It's like 125th Street in Harlem or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was the center of the mobilizing.
Okay.
And so the police were doing whatever they could to kind of shut that down. But and then what happened one day, and what they did was, starting like around 5 or 6 in the afternoon, they set up roadblocks where cars couldn't get to there.
Okay.
So, and I don't think this was an accident. One afternoon, I believe it was a Sunday afternoon, if I'm remembering right, one of the major black churches called for a big gathering, and this church is maybe about a mile or so away from West Florissant, and thousands of people came to there, and by the time the gathering was over, the police had set up their roadblocks around the center there. So it was almost, that made it very difficult to get back to the main center of action.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I believe that was planned. I really do.
Oh, I imagine so.
And then, in another instance, one of the what I call the respected leaders, one night when there was marching and stuff and there was a bit of disruption, and the police were threatening to arrest people and so on, and this guy came flying down the street with a bullhorn telling the police to be quiet, don't do anything. He said, let me do my job.
Okay. All right. And he was supposed to be an activist, I take it, trying to, you know, he was posing as an activist or an organizer.
He was one of the... he was a lawyer.
Okay. All right.
Jim Iman.
Yeah, Jim.
I haven't talked to you in a long time. The last time was on the air.
Yeah.
I should have called you last night. I would have reminded you.
Don't worry about it.
But anyway, I think this militarization of the police has been going on quite a while, but gradually, because they are afraid of the American people. They're afraid of unity of black, white, and brown workers. Once they make us superfluous... as Bill was talking about, which I don't think is going to work, but if there's going to be a revolution sooner or later. They're making it more and more difficult for the working class to organize and start something actually happening. The reason that Occupy Wall Street, which was a great idea, failed is there was no leadership. Was a leaderless revolution. Leaderless revolutions are not revolutions. They're a failed revolution to begin with. It was a good idea. But what are your thoughts on those? And what are your thoughts on what's going on in Greece right now, John?
Well, first of all, as far as Occupy, at least Occupy Oakland, you did have a leadership. They just denied they were the leadership. And so they couldn't really be held accountable. And in any movement, there's always going to be a leadership. And the only question is, are they out in the open? Is their program and their strategy clear? And are they democratically elected into the leadership? Or do they come into the leadership by some other means? So, and as far as the militarization of the police, you know, when they rousted the people out of Occupy Oakland, my God, you know, I mean, I've been around for quite a few years, but I had never seen such a display of police force as I saw then. They had what amounted to, armored personnel carriers and all kinds of stuff. And that was then, several years ago. And, of course, it's gotten worse now. And you see in Spain... they're preparing to pass a law to prohibit the filming of police while they're on duty.
Yeah, I heard this, yes.
And they've been trying to do that in different states here in the U.S. I see in Texas somebody's got a bill that prohibits anybody that's not recognized media from filming the police within 25 feet.
Hey, John, actually, Illinois had a real problem with that because when you record video, you're recording audio, and Illinois has always had an audio eavesdropping law, and there was a big row about this a few years ago over a person taping a traffic stop. And I mean, it was a really big issue here for two or three years. It took it to play out. And at one point they employed, I think it was a prostitute to, frame the guy who's doing the videotaping for home invasion.
And attempted rape.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So, I mean, the other side, I mean, you have to say, like, the new technology is, in that way, is something positive. You know, everybody has a video camera nowadays.
Yes, indeed. That's the thing that, you know, different from the, you know, let's say just 20 years ago when you had to actually make an effort to have a camera and stuff. Gus, did you, get some, this is
I
our...
wanted to mention one, yes. Make one comment about the role of the union leadership.
Oh, the union
because
leadership?
Because in all the protests that I've been on, the unions have been entirely absent. And in fact, I talked, when I was in Ferguson, I talked to one member of the UAW who told me that his union leadership had told him, this is not our battle.
Really?
And really? So when you talk about the, you know, corporate America, the capitalist class, being afraid of a big united mass movement that fights against the economic attacks but also against the racist attacks and combines that struggle, there's only one force in society that's even more afraid of that, and that's the union leadership.
Oh, yeah, John, you know, they're gomperists, and they just want pure and simple unionism, just taking care of their members.
If they wanted that, then at least they'd have an argument. But they're not even willing to fight on the issues of wages and working conditions.
They're worse than Samuel Gompers. Gompers, at least, as the Cigar Makers Union, had readers in there where somebody would read books, you know, while they were making cigars. But yeah, pure and simple unionism. Yeah, well, that was craft unionism. We had a revolution. We created the CIO, and what's become of it? They're nothing but pawns to the leadership of the Democratic Party,
and of the employers.
Yeah, this is an issue.
Every once in a while, they're forced to take on some kind of struggle, but they do it in such a way as to discourage their members from really getting involved and really turning out.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing. It seems like the national union leadership here in the United States, and I don't think it's uniquely American. It seems like some of our, you know, fellow workers in Britain have talked about this, about how, you know, with the Labor Party and the union leadership there, how they've actually become, you know, the leadership has become
new
part
labor.
Of the system. Yeah. Have they become part of the system themselves, and they, you know, aren't willing to rock the boat.
And that's why I jumped in with the idea, this idea of leader revolutions. And that's the main reason we've seen this historically, that, you know, vanguardism and leader revolutions have that happening, because you have such a displacement from the workers' revolutionary struggle that it happened in Haiti during the Haitian Revolution with Toussaint Louverture and the other Black Jacobins. They were so far removed from the revolution that it ultimately failed because they became a part of the established elite. And this is a historical trend that has happened in many revolutions in history. So this idea that there has to be a leader that is developed and elected democratically, how come there can't be a direct democracy-led revolutionary struggle with an objective at the center for all workers combined? Because that's what that's what Lenin learned after he got his ass kicked a few times and went back and said, you know what? What we have to do is think about this idea of, you know, we need to have a democratic revolutionary mindset for the collective people and not a leadership, because the leadership just got us beaten to the bricks by the czar. So that's the same thing that's happening now. You have a fervent mentality running through America right now in terms of police brutality and workers' rights, especially with this attack on unions, that these leaders, like these union leaders, are not going to do what we need to do. We've elected them, and we've selected them, and we propped them up, and they've done nothing for us. We're going to have to take matters into our own hands, which is what the Haitian slaves did without Toussaint Louverture after he had been killed. They took matters into their own hands, and they wiped out the rest of the French from the Haitian island, and they created their own independent state. Even though things happened later on that led to, because of mercantile capitalism, that led to the fall of that the actual revolution itself was a collective struggle without vanguardism or leadership.
After Napoleon captured Toussaint Louverture. He died in prison in France.
Yeah.
Dessalines had to resort slavery again.
Yeah.
To some extent.
Okay, John, your take on this? I know this is quite a yeah. Okay, John, your comments?
So, I mean, if you read that book, The Black Jacobins, which I'm sure you have.
Yes.
I mean, he makes it, it's perfectly clear in there that there was a leadership all through the revolution. And, I mean, that whole theory, you know, like you, that was that was supposedly what Occupy Oakland was based on, was the General Assemblies, and there is no leadership, and we're, but it was just completely untrue. There was a leadership. There was a leadership that I know because for a period I was involved in it. They discussed and in advance the whole idea of a general strike. I was involved in those discussions. They figured out how to present it at the General Assembly, and I think that that was right. But the only problem is that afterwards, that same leadership got tied in with the union bureaucracy, and there was no accountability. There was no clarity. Who is the leadership? What is their program? How do we replace? How do they get in there in the first place? And how do we replace them? The leadership was just who had the most time, who had the most determination, who was organized in advance, and it's the same thing in the unions.
Yeah. Yeah, and then those unions that you can't vote, that is, like the carpenters, we have no say.
No, it's actually like things that happen in a lot of organizations where you have, that are more informal authority and legit, you know, as opposed to legitimate assigned authority or avowed authority. And it can be a problem even in companies.
It has to be formalized, including what you stand for. Make that be part of what's formalized.
Yeah, yes. What I'm saying is any group of people are going to have some people who put a lot more into it and some people who are thinking more, and they are basically de facto leaders like you're talking about, and I can really see what you're saying is they are not accountable for their influence.
Whether you like it or not, it's going to be that way. Right.
Yes.
As much as I want leaderless revolutions, I'm afraid that it can't happen, at least with people with the psychology that we have currently.
Yeah, Jim?
It's a beautiful view from the Golden Gate Bridge. And I really want to be able to step off the bridge and just float in midair.
Don't be tempted, John.
But that's what I'm saying. What you know, you have to deal with the actual forces.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the forces are ominous. They're also, as Mao Zedong would say, a paper tiger in the final instance. They have the guns, but we have the numbers. And it's a question
again, it's a question of being organized.
Yes.
Because if the great majority is unorganized and unclear as to their position in society and their goals and that sort of thing, and the minority is organized and is clear, the minority is going to win every time.
That's a very good point. Gus, any last words on this?
Yeah, like I said, I mean, just putting it into a more contemporary context, in the sense that I agree with Bill in that I don't want it to be a leaderless revolution, but we are creatures of habit. This is from a historical standpoint that we repeatedly do. And I can take it to the research that I do in Atlanta. The first thing that the Atlanta black working class did was they elected the leadership to look after them. But what happened was they created their own set of objectives and agenda that was so different from what the working class people needed, which was housing and labor and jobs. They went off and started looking at highway building and public accommodations past what they're in, and busing and things like that. Busing was important, but the working class people said, there's no point in me worrying about busing when I can't even feed my family. And the middle class people, those leaders were saying, well, we know what's better for you. We can do this, but they have been so far removed from that group. And so that's my issue with when it comes to leadership in revolutionary struggles, is that they separate themselves and their agendas from